I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
Mike Carlson. Blues work it out to center.
Hey, hockey's a tough sport.
Matt Tennyson, and he's hit hard, and he is hurt.
Nobody forced these guys to play. Some people might say they're lucky to get any money, considering the court already threw out their lawsuit.
He's in a lot of pain right now.
But over the next 2 weeks, hundreds of former NHL hockey players will each have a decision to make. Dangling in front of them is a cash settlement from the NHL. It's not huge, but it's not nothing either. It's the result of negotiation after the lawsuit I mentioned was dismissed. That lawsuit alleged that the league failed to warn or protect its players from the head injuries that are, you know, part of hockey. But in order to get that money, the players will have to sign away a list of things, including, chief among them, their right to pursue legal action against the league for any claim of head trauma, or else they can reject the settlement, keep their rights, and go it alone, taking on the league in court. Depending on how many players take this deal and how much noise the remaining holdouts can make, many of them have spoken loudly already, this is either the final chapter of hockey's legal battle over brain injuries or just the latest in a long and unwinding saga. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Dan Robson is a senior writer and head of features at The Athletic Canada. He's also the author of several books about players current and former. Dan, first of all, tell me where the class action suit came from.
Well, basically back in 2013, a group of players, sort of in line with what was happening with the NFL,
right,
came forward with counsel to sort of set a claim saying that alleging that the NHL had information about the effects of concussions on future neurological disorders that had been kept from them in their playing days, and they were not properly informed. Therefore, they believed that the NHL was sort of liable for the effects that they were facing later on in life.
And what happened to that suit over the last few years?
So it was a heavily contentious debate that battled back and forth sort of ferociously. Yeah. The NHL didn't budge at all in any capacity. And basically after 5 years of going back and forth in court this summer, the class action proposal was dismissed by a court in Minnesota, sorry, in St. Paul's, because basically the legal claim that they were trying to make just wasn't going to stand up in class action certification. And they had an uphill battle. It's very difficult to sort of gain class action certification. And they sort of fought and fought and fought, but at the same time, the NHL fought and fought and fought as well.
And so now there are 300-some players.
318. Yeah.
318 who were hoping to be part of a class action suit. What were their options when the suit was tossed?
Basically, they had nothing. I mean, really, when the suit is tossed, they're on their own, right? So you, in terms of the group, which they had, you know, you would have been able to have sort of that force to be able to go at it as a whole. Now it's sort of individual cases. In some cases, that might be beneficial for some of the players, but as a whole, they were basically sunk. And so the NHL really didn't have to do anything beyond that.
But
I mean, and they decided that they'd come forward in agreement with the counsel of the players, with the plaintiffs. You know, and that the judge also sort of nudged them in this direction and encouraged them to find some sort of resolution. The NHL came forward with a concussion settlement, a proposal that came forward in November of this year. Basically, it outlines a payment to the players involved, which comes to approximately about $22,000 US per player, as well as a promise of neurological testing. And then beyond that, there was a fund that would allow players who were deemed, you know, in need of more support in this way, they would be given up to $75,000 in care. Now, that comes from a limited pot of about $1.1 million, though.
So every player now has to decide on their own whether or not they want to be part of this?
Right. So they're given initially a date of 75, a timeline of 75 days in which they were going to be able to decide if they were going to opt in or opt out. That has since been extended. That expired last Friday. That's since been extended 3 weeks. So in the next few weeks, you're going to find players that there'll be players that will need to sort of decide if they're going to be joining or not. And it's been the players I've chatted with, I mean, it's been a difficult decision. There's a large legal document in front of them, and they have to sort of decide what exactly they're signing off to.
So who are these players? Who are we talking about here? What era? Any names we recognize?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a wide range of names. I mean, some of the younger players, the ones that are more recent to recognize would be a Dan Carcillo, who's obviously been one of the most vocal proponents of trying to take action against the league and trying to create a more awareness of the realities of head injuries and what they do. Other players, I mean, you go back in the eras to, Gary Lehman was a part of this, right? And Gary Lehman played through the 80s and 90s. He was a great player at that time. He was one of the bigger names involved. There's players that go further back that people might not even recognize. Quite a bunch that people might not recognize that played through, the 70s and 80s and 90s, and that I guess you would sort of classify as, marginal players.
Right, and guys that didn't make a ton of money, presumably.
And that's key. Yeah, a lot of players who, you see people sort of on the one angle sort of criticizing this as sort of a money grab. Well, there are a lot of players who wouldn't have made the kind of salaries that we sort of frame a professional hockey player within today. So I think, there's a lot of players that, for example, $22,000.
Right. It sounds like nothing to today's NHL.
Right.
Well, it is nothing.
It is nothing to them. But it's nothing. It's something that they can't just sort of sniff at. And some of the players I've chatted with have acknowledged that. They said, I'm not entirely comfortable with where we stand, but I have an option of either taking something or nothing.
You talked to a bunch of these guys. Well, I guess first you mentioned Dan Carcillo. So tell me his story and tell me what he's doing about this settlement.
Well, Dan is, as I said, one of the more vocal personalities out there who, suffered greatly in his career and has been quite open about the trauma that he sort of faced through, he believes injuries on the ice that carried into his life through neurological disorders. He's done a lot of research on it, and he's sort of created a sort of an ongoing, campaign to challenge the NHL and the status quo about, the culture of just accepting head injury as a part of the game and denying the realities that down the road this causes neurological disorders. So Dan has been one of those guys who's been sort of front and center in the case. And he's a person that I think is attempting to, help educate other players the best he can.
So he's not taking the settlement.
He is vehemently not taking the settlement, though. He's urging others, and I should say he's urging others to make the best decision for themselves. He would say don't take the settlement, but at the same time, you have to acknowledge that it's presumptuous to assume that somebody can say no to something like $22,000. So he's saying read through the settlement, make sure you're checking with counsel, maybe not necessarily your own counsel within the case, because within the case, the plaintiff's counsel have agreed to this concussion settlement. They were negotiated it,
yeah.
And they're suggesting that the players take it, obviously. It's important to note that within the settlement, too, the NHL is covering the attorney's fees. Now, the attorneys aren't coming off with a huge win here. Basically, it's covering the majority of the money is going to cover just what they would have lost in time that they put into this case, and a small gain on top of it. But really, for attorneys that are involved in this, this is not like a giant windfall, but it does cover them.
Well, what's like the total value of the entire settlement?
It's $18.9 million
compared to. We were colleagues at Sportsnet together, mm-hmm. back in the day, and I covered some concussion issues in the NFL,
right.
And wrote about that. And the NFL settlement.
Mm-hmm.
was huge.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's about, you could say, I think approximately $1 billion. But one of the main things to think about there is that you're really comparing, in many ways, two different leagues and two different realities. One of the things that was a challenge for the NHL concussion settlement coming forward was that only 318 players were involved. And
right.
I should note, some players don't even seem to be aware that they are involved. And that's an issue within that as well.
What do you mean by that?
They'd sign up sort of, they were getting, there was an effort to suggest, be part of this, like we need to do this. And so I've talked to, some players who were sort of not really paying attention to everything that went along and
yeah.
kind of said like, oh, yeah, I forgot my name was even sort of a part of that. Like they kind of put it in. I mean, that's,
someone had asked him to join because there was a potential yeah. for a settlement down the line, and they said, okay, add me to the list.
And I think that speaks to one of the main problems that the NHL faced in this, that the of NHL players that were seeking this designation faced. There wasn't as much of a united front as you had seen in the NFL.
Yeah.
There wasn't as much media pressure, and there wasn't as much at stake because, frankly, the NHL is a much smaller league in terms of its mass amount of money, frankly, and what it is in
the
culture.
But there's also kind of a pack mentality to the NFL that you haven't seen in this NHL settlement. For instance, when we were naming who's in it, you said Gary Lehman is one of the biggest names in it. Now, Gary Lehman is not, generally speaking, a big name. There are no stars involved in this lawsuit.
Right. There are no stars involved in this lawsuit. And I can't speak to exactly why that is, but yeah. I would suggest that I do think it's fair to say that there is a underlying culture in hockey.
Yeah.
And in professional hockey that sort of refuses to push against sort of the narrative and to sort of, you know, battle against the NHL in some way. And also, I mean, a lot of former players are still employed by the NHL. There's
right.
a lot of people who find their livelihood still within the NHL. So it's a culture that that doesn't have a lot of, I guess, the right word would be rebels, for lack of a better word, in it.
You talk to a ton of former players. You wrote books on Johnny Bauer, Clint Malarchuk, Pat Quinn. I remember at Sportsnet, you wrote a lot about Gordie Howe. Mm-hmm. These are old
yeah.
guys who played in a very different league.
Mm.
How do they feel about, first of all, the issues that have been raised now, and second of all, about whether or not they should be compensated?
I mean, you know, within that realm, I think it's different, I guess. I mean, like,
right.
you know, it's hard to know exactly how they feel about what their colleagues are trying to pursue. And I don't think they would presume to put themselves in a position of saying, I think my colleague, my former teammate should do this or the other.
How do they feel about their own heads?
But I mean, that's a question I always ask, right? And I've always found that. I mean, obviously, like, you know, Gordie Howe and Johnny Bauer lived quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They also, as I've chronicled, sustained a great deal of injuries. But, you know, Johnny cognitively was quite sharp right to the end. So, I mean, it's sort of a, you know, remarkable case there. Gordie, you know, suffered from dementia in his later years. I mean, and he was quite, you know, quite elderly at that time. Other players, I think I've been more interested in chatting with some of the players I've spoken to over with stories that are younger, and they all I kind of always get the sense, I don't know if something's wrong with my brain. Maybe there might be something wrong with my brain. I'm not really sure, but there isn't sort of a notion of this is the NHL's fault. I'm going to go and get the NHL for it, or I need support from it. So, I mean, there is definitely a large group of people, I would say, that would say, you know, that this is part of the game.
What I wonder, and again, going back to football, is there's a huge conversation whenever you talk to anybody inside football.
Mm-hmm.
Would you let your kid play this game? Mm-hmm. Does this game have a future? If I knew then what I know now mm-hmm. with some of the older players, would I have quit earlier? Would I have even played in the first place?
I mean, I can only speak to players I've talked to
yeah, of course.
About that. But for example, Dan Carcillo, for example, explicitly says no. There's
yeah.
not a chance he would. Put his player in if he loves the game of hockey, but without changes to the game of hockey. I think that's key as well. I mean, it's also he's suggesting that there can be changes that can be made, and there are there are groups that are actively trying to find ways to reduce the realities of concussions and head injury and head trauma in sport. But we're not there yet, and it's a long way away from that.
So over the next couple of weeks, a bunch of these players will presumably take the settlement. The ones that don't, what are their options? Do you have a sense of how many of them are going to go after the league on their own?
So I've been told that there are at least about a dozen players who, and that's sort of that's very sort of a superficial survey,
right?
And I don't think we won't necessarily know entirely, but I've been told on two sides. I mean, chatting with one side, I mean, I think the majority, it sounds like, of players are saying, you know, I'll sign up and take this, or a good amount of players have agreed to sort of sign off and say, you know what, I can't afford to fight the league on this anymore. And also, my symptoms are not that bad right now. I'm okay. I'm here with my brothers, my old teammates who are in serious trouble. I'm here to support them. So I can't on my own take on the league. But then there are players who are in you know, very difficult situations that have strong cases against their counsel would suggest they have strong cases against the league.
Who?
Based on, well, like a Nick Boynton, for example. He's basically was a, you know, a player through, he retired in, I think it was 2011. I played for a variety of teams in the NHL. But he's sort of become, along with Dan, sort of Dan Carcillo, sort of this voice of one of the most sort of more recent players who have suffered greatly with you know, with anxiety and depression and other effects that are believed to be related to head trauma that he would have sustained on the ice. And so he's been quite vocal about how the culture of the league continued to put him in a position where he would sustain head trauma. And he's angry about that. And he's basically said to me, you know, wait, if anybody's on the fence about taking the settlement, wait till I have my day in court. Because what he's suggesting, obviously, is that he believes he has a strong case and it'll sort of lead the path for others to also come forward on their own and say, I'm not going to settle on this, with this agreement. I'm going to go after the NHL on my own and say that my case is, you know, it's as a single entity, you know, has a strong claim.
And those guys like Boynton and Carcillo, those are guys who played in the modern era, so have those resources that we associate with an NHL career in the 21st century, right? Like Nick Boynton presumably has some money for lawyers.
Right. And I guess one other thing, though, that is important and that I think shouldn't sort of dissuade anybody that is thinking about they might have a strong case is that a lot of these cases are taken on contingency as well. So there are lawyers out there that will say, you know what, I'm going to represent you because I believe you have a strong case, even though financially, you know, you can't back this, you can't fund this action against, you know, a league that defends itself strongly and doesn't back down. So I do think, though, you know, one thing to consider is that if there is a strong case, then there's always a possibility of getting support legally.
When you talk to players like Dan Carcillo or like Nick Boynton, who describe the kind of culture that forces them to push their brains and to get back onto the ice and to play through these concussions, what kinds of situations do they describe? What does that look like to a player who's out there?
There's the implicit and the sort of the explicit. I mean, there's the implicit culture of, and you've heard this many times, like, oh, you just got your bell rung, get back out there.
Yeah.
There's the reality that if you're seen to sort of not be tough and not be able to, you know, push through and keep playing, that it says something about your character and your value to the team and that kind of stuff. And that's all implicit. I mean, that's never explicitly said. But there's other times, too, where they've talked about, you know, in a period of time sort of being given, you know, different kinds of pills and different kinds of treatments for, you know, things that they're feeling, which they believe are clearly a result of a head trauma, you know, sort of things that deal with, you know, to calm you down and help you get sleep or to help you get deal with pain that are, you know, dangerous. And that sort of just helps, you know, blanket the problem and also perhaps cause other problems. But within that, knowing that there was severe trauma sustained, but then still being the best experts that they might have surrounding the team, basically saying, well, here's how you're going to treat it. So, of course, you're going to listen to that. So the allegation there is that, you know, there was an implicit and at times a very explicit sort of culture of, I would, for lack of a better phrase, like pushing through it and making sure that, you know, you're a professional athlete, you've got to keep playing.
Well, Dan Carcillo is interesting, too, because he was part of sort of a class, like a generation of NHL tough guys, of which a handful died really young.
Well, and he was incredibly close to Steve Monitor, you know, and speaking with him about his late friend who passed away far too young, 35, I believe it was, several years ago, a few years ago now, you know, Steve suffered greatly from issues that could be argued were related to head trauma that he sustained on the ice. And I mean, this has been clearly laid out, you know, in Ken Dryden's book, Game Change, where he talks about Steve Monitor's condition. And I think that, you know, that's something that drives Dan now and speaking with him. He's been quite open about that as well. And talking about him and other players who suffered from issues like, you know, depression and anxiety and other.
There's Derek Bugard. There was Rick Rippon. There was Wade Belak. And I feel like that was all within the span of like 4 or 5 years, right around as we were kind of waking up to the reality of this.
And it makes it, and I think all those examples, those names that you mentioned, I think we need to remember and read and look at their stories and understand what they were going through and see the warning signs that were there. And I think that has happened to a certain extent. I think obviously, in general, people more cognizant of the realities of issues with that they're related to sort of, for in many cases, mental illness, but maybe not quite so related to how head trauma can relate to that as well. And I think that's something that, you know, they're still fighting for. And that's something that obviously also the NHL is going to fight against, the idea that there is a direct demonstrable causation between concussions or head trauma affected on the ice and issues like with mental health and stuff. I mean, that's something that you're going to fight against greatly. So it's one of the ongoing battles.
What do you think happens after February 6th? So a number of players take the settlement, the ones that don't. I'm sure the NHL is hoping that after the deadline passes, this can kind of fade away?
Well, the NHL has the right to, if they don't like the, within the settlement agreement, if they don't like the amount of, the number of players that have signed on, they can actually sort of say, well, ripping the settlement up, like this is off the table. It doesn't sound like that's going to happen because I am hearing that a good majority have signed on and that apparently the reason that the deadline was extended, it's quite common in a situation like this. Some players haven't been able to get, their counsel haven't been able to get in touch with them to get them to officially sign the papers, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, I don't, you know, without speculating too much, I mean, I think from where it sounds like things are right now, you will get a lot of players who will take that settlement, take that money, and you know, fair, because it's something they might need. And that's something that I don't think anyone should, you know, be critical of at all. But at the same time, and also they are getting some, you know, there is some value in the testing. There is some value in the support, and you know, we shouldn't dismiss that either. You are then, I think, now going to then see the other cases that come forward, and you're going to see individual suits against the NHL that are basically then going to be, you know, publicized and fought. And I expect that the NHL will continue to fight those cases as diligently as they always have. And the players I've spoken to, though, I think, you know, you'll see them with cases that I think, you know, will be quite alarming for people to read about.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Dan Robson, senior writer and head of features at The Athletic Canada. That was The Big Story. For more from us, you can visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find us on any podcast app you choose. You can hit us up with any of your ideas for a story or just your comments on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN, and you can find us and all our brother and sister shows at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. The Big Story is produced by Claire Broussard. Ryan Clark is our assistant producer. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk on Monday.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.